the more people know about what's going on, the angrier they are about it.
Hi, I'm Mike Riggs with Reason TV, and I'm here today with Radley Balco, author of Rise of the Warrior Cop. Radley's also an alumnus of Reason Magazine and an investigative reporter with the Huffington Post. Radley, good to have you here today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So, what is the Warrior Cop? Where did it come from?
Well, the Warrior Cop is basically this idea that police have become more militarized, more soldier-like in the last probably generation or two. And it applies, you know, to the weapons that they're using, to the uniforms that they wear, which have switched from sort of the police blues to these battle dress uniforms, which mimic military uniforms, to the tactics they use, to, you know, what I think is the most kind of pervasive problem, which is the mindset that police officers take to the job. And this has been fostered by, you know, a number of policies, some of which, you know, didn't necessarily intend this to be the outcome, but also just a lot of war and sort of martial rhetoric from politicians over the years that has also sort of nudged this trend to where we are today.
So you put the birthplace of the SWAT team, which is a big part of police militarization, Los Angeles, the LAPD, the brainchild of Daryl Gates, who worked for the LAPD, and it was a response to the Watts riots in 1965, the Clock Tower shooting in Austin with Charles Whitman. And at the time, you don't criticize Gates for this. You're saying maybe it was sensible at the time to say police, as we knew them in 1965, were not actually prepared for situations of urban violence with shooters in buildings and that kind of thing. So at what point would you say that the SWAT team went from this idea to be used like very selectively in very certain, very violent situations? When did it become this thing that was normal to use wherever, whenever?
So I think there are two trends that were going on in the late 60s and early 70s. One was, as you mentioned, this rise of the SWAT team that started in LA. And after two really high profile incidents, one with the Black Panthers and one with the Symbionese Liberation Army, that were, both of these raids were televised, got the SWAT a lot of publicity, started spreading to other cities. And so, you know, we go from one SWAT team in about 1970 to about 500 by 1975. But, you know, throughout the 70s, the SWAT teams were used in these emergency type situations. So again, you know, riots and hostage takings and bank robberies. And they were used in situations where the government was using violence to defuse an already violent situation, right, where lives were immediately at risk. At the same time, you have this other trend, which is Nixon's drug war. So Nixon declares war on drugs, starts really kind of amping up the battlefield rhetoric with respect to drugs. He pushes the no-knocker aid through Congress, which, you know, was actually the brainchild of a 29-year-old Senate aide. You know, it wasn't something that police chiefs were demanding. It wasn't something criminologists were saying was necessary. This was a political ploy, basically. But both of these trends are sort of moving parallel until the 1980s, and it's really during the Reagan administration that we see them converge, and this is where we start to see SWAT teams used for to serve warrants on people suspected of nonviolent consensual drug crimes. And here, now SWAT teams are actually creating violence where there was none before. And this is where I think, you know, the trend really starts to become problematic.
We've got to a point where we've gone from hostage situations, armed shooters, this kind of stuff, to police creating violence where there was none. And it's largely because of Nixon dehumanizing drug users, drug dealers. And then things sort of, there becomes a moment where we pause and say, wait a minute, is this a good idea? I mean, when does this happen?
So Nixon declares war on drugs. He pushes through the no-knock raid bill through Congress. And what happens, a couple things happen. So Congress passed two bills, one that applied to federal narcotics agents doing federal investigations anywhere in the country. The other bill applied only to the D.C. Police Department, because Congress has jurisdiction over D.C. So what was fascinating is there are two different reactions. In D.C., the police chief at the time, Jerry Wilson, was a very kind of forward-thinking police chief, took a very less reactionary approach to crime. And he actually refused to implement the no-knock law. He said it wasn't necessary. He said, you know, there was no need to barge into people's homes like this. And, you know, oddly enough, crime actually went down in D.C. over the next few years while it went up in the rest of the country. At the federal level, things were very different. You had these narcotics agents who made full use of this law, and they were, you know, raiding homes left and right. They were raiding homes without warrants. They were, you know, terrorizing innocent people. But these weren't SWAT teams. These were narcotics cops in street clothes, basically undercover cops, and they were kicking down doors. And what happened was there were a few raids that really started to pick up some national attention. And Congress actually shows some remorse and shame. They hold hearings, they bring victims in to testify, and they actually end up repealing both no-knock laws. And not only that, they pass another law making the federal government liable anytime a federal agent commits a raid on the wrong house. So it was this rare moment where, you know, the drug war was still sort of intractable, or wasn't completely intractable. Congress could actually admit it made a mistake and gone a little bit too far and actually rein things in a little bit. That's unfortunately pretty much the last time that would happen.
So that's our last bright spot. And that's not even being cynical or hyperbolic. I mean, really, between then and now, that's the last time anybody's going to say, maybe let's slow down.
Well, I mean, the Carter administration really kind of put a brake on all of this as well. But then, unfortunately, as Carter left office, there were a bunch of scandals where, you know, it was rumored that his own drug czar had done cocaine at a normal party. And so the Reagan people come in and they really kind of use the negative publicity from the Carter administration's sort of lax attitude toward drugs to really kind of fill all these positions with moralists and, you know, people who took a very kind of it's just about right and wrong sort of approach to the war on drugs. And this is where we really see the both the rhetoric and the policy start to escalate.
Now we see SWAT teams raiding small friendly poker games you've talked about. There was, I think, 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, the Department of Education used a SWAT team to raid the home of a couple who had maybe used some sort of mail fraud to get student loans they didn't need.
Yeah.
Which obviously, you know, against the law, but does it require a SWAT team?
Yeah.
What happens that we go from SWAT teams for drug houses to raiding poker games at people's homes to raiding people who had maybe done mail fraud or something?
I think there are a couple periods where we kind of enter new ground in this issue. The first is in 1996 when California legalizes medical marijuana. And, you know, up until that point, the justification for using these kinds of heavy-handed tactics was always that, you know, drug dealers are terrible people, they're dangerous, they're heavily armed, they're career criminals, you know, they wouldn't think twice before taking out a cop. And, you know, a lot of that wasn't true. There were counter-arguments to all those points, but at least they were making the argument, right? They were saying, we need this amount of force because of this threat we're facing is significant, and we need to protect, you know, officer safety. Once California legalized medical marijuana and the federal government now starts sending SWAT teams in to raid these dispensaries, that justification goes out the window, right? I mean, these are businesses that are openly operating. They have business licenses. They're operating in compliance with state law. I mean, nobody can seriously argue that the, you know, hippie mom and pop couple who run the pot dispensary are a threat to, you know, pull an AR-15 out from under the counter and kill a bunch of federal agents. This was about sending a political message. These people were openly flouting federal law, and so we had to bring the boot down on them to make an example of them. And this is really sort of terrifying territory that we enter in the 1990s, and of course it's still going on today. This is government using violence to send a political message, and that's, you know, that's not something we normally associate with free societies. The next sort of frontier, I think, comes, there wasn't sort of a make or break moment when it happened, but I think just in the last probably 7 or 8 years, we've really seen SWAT mission creep grow beyond the drug war. And now, you know, as you said, we're seeing these raids on poker games, particularly when the Texas Hold'em craze started taking off in the mid-2000s. We saw SWAT teams breaking up neighborhood poker games at bars that were openly advertised were raided with SWAT teams. You know, Reason TV did a story about the VFW hall in Dallas that was raided by a SWAT team because they were conducting charity poker games. And here's where we really start to see the mission creep and SWAT sort of looking for new reasons to use this sort of force. You know, there's the old saying, when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And I think really in the last decade, that's really where we've seen this happen. And, you know, now we're out to the point where, you know, we're seeing SWAT raids for regulatory inspections. It's now become sort of an end around the Fourth Amendment. There have been lots of raids on bars where, you know, it was basically just a drug sweep, but the police used, you know, brought somebody from the alcohol inspection board to come with them, and now it's, you know, officially an alcohol inspection. We're just making sure your liquor's properly labeled, but we're going to go ahead and point our guns at all your customers and search them.
Your book, up until the very end, where you get to the sort of reform section, by the time you get to the reform section, actually even in the beginning of the reform section, which is about the story of Che Calvo, the mayor of Berwyn Heights in Maryland, you feel hopeless.
Yeah.
You feel like this is intractable. Nevertheless, you do have some suggestions for reform. You list, you know, accountability, transparency, changing police culture. You know, what are the most important ones? Which ones do you really, because, you know, every reformer has a wish list.
Yeah.
And it includes some, you know, starry-eyed stuff. What's the stuff that you really think would work
Well, that's the problem. I mean, the stuff that would be most effective is the stuff that's least likely to happen. So yeah, ending the drug war, you know, reining SWAT in to only serve warrants in these. I mean, if I could write a rule, and I'm not anti-SWAT team, I do think there's an appropriate use for them. If I could write a rule, it would be that, you know, SWAT teams should only be used when an act of violence is being committed or about to be committed, actual violence, right? That would be a great rule. It's never going to pass because, you know, sending SWAT teams out on drug raids is financially, it brings revenue into police departments through federal grants and asset forfeiture. But that would be a great rule. But also, I mean, you know, part of it is just building up the will for reform. And, you know, what I found, and actually this is, you know, encouraging in an otherwise pretty cynical book, the more people know about what's going on, the angrier they are about it. And I talk about this raid in Columbia, Missouri that was recorded a few years ago and posted online. And, you know, this was a very standard raid. I mean, it was just like every other one of these drug raids, but it was, you know, it was extraordinarily violent. They shoot the dog. There's, you know, a kid in the house they didn't know about. You know, they come in shooting and screaming and, you know, with all their guns. And what was amazing is it gets posted online and the reaction was just, the video goes viral and the reaction was just outrage. I mean, the police department, their phone lines were shut down, you know, their email got shut down because they were overwhelmed, they got death threats. And it was almost as if, you know, it was actually like, you know, the internet generation for the first time was seeing how the drug war was actually fought on the ground, and they were very, very angry by what they saw. And I think, you know, just transparency will do a lot. I mean, I think if we can just get word out about what's happening, then I think we can build up the will for some reform. So I think all these raids should be recorded, and those videos should be subject to FOIA and open records requests.
Well, Radley, thank you for being here today, for talking about your book, Rise of the Warrior Cop.
Thanks for having me on.
For Reason TV, I'm Mike Riggs.